Acorns are dropping off my Chinese house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Welcome to Yarns at Yin Hu, a podcast about the fiber arts and other post-apocalyptic skills. Episode 125, Who's the Knitter? Sunday, June 19th, 2016. I'm your host, Sarah. You can find me on social media as Sarah Pomegranate. The Yarns at Yin Hu podcast has a Facebook page, and it's available on iTunes. Today's episode features the following segments: On the Porch, Ever-Expanding Skill Set, and Off the Shelf. Last night, I went to my local cinema to see Maggie's Plan, a film that I hadn't even watched the trailer, and I hadn't seen it in any of the previous films that I've seen. So I really knew nothing about it. I hadn't even looked at the poster for this film. So I was unprepared for the vast array of knitwear and textiles that appear in this film. If you enjoy seeing knits on screen and you enjoy thinking about the costume designer's choices for a character, I recommend that you see Maggie's Plan and try to see it on the big screen. It will not disappoint. There's lots and lots to look at. And it's a blend of some commercial items as well as what seemed to me to be clearly hand-knit items. I was just fascinated, and I think I was leaning forward in my seat, probably with my mouth slightly open, when Samuel turned to me and he said, "Who's the knitter?" So he had noticed it as well, and I had been looking for a reference to knitting in the main character's apartment or to see her in a scene where she was knitting. And that frustrated me until deep, deep into the film. There's a very brief scene when Maya Rudolph has some knitting in her hands. And the cutting of the film in that scene made it unclear whether she really knows how to knit or not. There was no mention made of knitting, and Maya Rudolph does not play a major role in the film. So I'm not sure what we were to make of the hand knits, but this morning I've had a little bit of time. I just saw the 9:45 showing last night, and it's 8 a.m. now, so I haven't had a lot of time to do research, but I did find an interview with the costume designer Malgosia Terzanska on IndieWire, and I have linked it in the show notes. And she talks a bit about her choices for the characters and the costuming, which I thought was very interesting. This film is written and directed by Rebecca Miller, who never disappoints. She's amazingly intelligent and creative. She has films with strong female characters and uses a lot of women in the film industry to help her put her films together. So she really promotes the careers of women. The film stars Greta Gerwig and Ethan Hawke, and Greta Gerwig is doing her pretty typical quirky New York 20 or 30 something character. It also stars Bill Fader, Maya Rudolph, and Julianne Moore. It seems like Maggie's Plan is playing predominantly at independent theaters and art house type theaters, but I know that not many people see films in movie theaters anymore. So if you're interested, you can explore ways to check this out at home. We'll be right back. On the porch. I'm still working on Paper Crane's shawl by Lori Versace, but I have fewer than 100 rows to go with this shawl. So I think this will be the last time I mention it until I talk about having completed it. I'm still liking the knitting of this shawl. It's rhythmic. It's very calming. I like the blue color of the yarn, and I think it's going to be really pretty and versatile once I finish the project. I will finish this project. I'm hoping that it will be done by midweek this week. I have also been working on some spinning because it's just been really lovely weather the past few days, and this is the time that I like to pull spinning projects out on the porch and work on them. So I've been spinning some new-to-me fiber from a classmate in my sheep-to-shawl course. Kathy Stanwood received a fleece. It's an East Frisian Tunis cross fleece. She brought it to class in June and allowed anyone who was interested to take some home and try it out. This sheep was not bred as a fleece sheep for hand spinning, and certainly the shearer was not a shearer accustomed to shearing a fleece for hand spinning. So the fleece has quite a few problems with it. There are a lot of second cuts. The tips are matted together and very dirty, as well as brittle. And the fleece itself is very, very dirty with a lot of veg matter. However, there are a lot of great aspects to this fleece. Like with Jacob, there are differing color gradations and differing fiber qualities depending on where you take fiber from the fleece. And I just took from one section along the side. But even so, there's quite a bit of variety in the color and the texture and the staple length. Overall, the staple length of this fleece is quite long, so it's pretty strong, and it's very, very soft. So in preparing the fleece, I tried to maximize the strengths of this fiber and overcome some of the deficits. I started by cutting off the tips of the fleece. They would be coming off anyway. They would either come off in the carding process, they would pill up as I was spinning, they would pill up during the plying, or they would pill on any finished garment. So it just seemed to me to cut all that waste at the beginning of the process. And then I had the added benefit of being able to separate the fibers much more carefully. And when I washed the fleece, much more of that dirt and vegetable matter came out. More came out as I carded. And just before carding, I separated the fleece into piles depending on the color. Once it was clean, I could see the colors very clearly. And then I worked to create a gradient from light to dark. And then I added a little bit of the lighter colored Jacob fleece to my gradient too. I created rolags, and then I divided all of the rolags into two piles so that I can spin two singles and then ply them together, preserving the color gradation. I think this is going to be a really beautiful yarn. It's spinning quite thin. It's strong, but it's fine. And I'm hoping for maybe 500 or 600 yards of fingering weight yarn from this fleece. Of course, I always overestimate the yardage that I'm going to get. We shall see. But it did spin up finer than my usual default spin. Yesterday, I spun one entire bobbin. So I did the gradient all the way from light to dark. And then I just have one more to spin before I start plying. Likely, I will finish this project during Tour de Fleece, the spinning competition that begins on July 2nd. And I also have some 50-50 Merino Silk Blend from Three Waters Farm that I'm going to be spinning as well. So I plan to compete with Team Three Waters Farm for this year's Tour de Fleece. My travel spinning project remains the Batwings from Hobbledehoy in the Hello Sunshine colorway. I'm currently spinning my third of eight of these Batwings in beautiful yellows, oranges with a bit of blue. And I have these in my handbag with my Turtle Made Turkish spindle, which is perfect for on-the-go spinning because it's very durable and it's lightweight, so it packs great in my purse. I also spent a bit of time yesterday continuing my work on last year's Sheep to Shawl project. At the end of last year, in December, our final class, I presented my teachers and my classmates with my final knitted garment made from hand-processed, hand-spun, and hand-dyed wool. My project was a poncho, and after wearing it to the final class, I never wore it again. So sometime in January, I think, I ripped out the entire project and wound it into one giant ball. But with 100% wool yarn, it can be very difficult just to knit back from yarn that has already been knitted without re-skeining it and soaking it. And I had been sort of in denial that that's what I would need to do. So yesterday I put that giant ball in a big bowl on the porch, and then I wound skein after skein of my hand-spun yarn. Then I gave everything a bath in some very warm water and some soak, and because it was such a breezy, beautiful, sunny day, everything dried within a few hours. That yarn is ready to knit up again, and I do have a more, I guess, a shaped design for a poncho in my mind. The thing about the Sheep to Shawl class is that you're really responsible for designing your knit garment as well as knitting it. So even though I could see a lot of different patterns on Ravelry for something I could make with this yarn, I really have to come up with something of my own. And so I've just been thinking about ponchos and looking at photographs of ponchos on Ravelry, and I've come up with an idea for something that I would like to try with this yarn. And now that it's more organized and I can see the colors a little bit more clearly, I think that will be easier. Another challenge in making a garment is that I need to make it with all of these different colors. So some things that I could imagine with a single color, they might look a little childish or immature if done with a whole range of colors. So I need to choose my color placement and my color management very carefully. All of that is ready for some work this summer, and I'm not sure exactly when I'm going to begin that project or restart that project, but I do have it in mind for the front porch this summer. Ever-expanding skill set. This month, I'm cooking with coconut in all of its forms. I have yet to try the coconut flour, but yesterday I made a coconut custard pie, and I'm very, very pleased with the results. I've been experimenting with lard in my pie crust, And a couple weeks ago, I tried a pie crust made entirely with lard that was kind of a disappointment. I'm not sure if it was the humidity, which was partially to blame, or that I really didn't care for the texture of an all lard crust. So for my most recent pie, I used my tried and true recipe. It's more like an internalized process than a recipe. I always use 1¼ cups of flour and 1/3 cup of fat. 1/3 cup is 5 1/3 tablespoons. So yesterday I used 4 1/3 tablespoons of butter and 1 tablespoon of lard as the fat in my crust. I added a little bit of salt, even though my butter has salt in it. And I cut the fat into the flour with my pastry blender and then added ice cold water. After I bring the dough together into a disc, I always wrap it in plastic wrap, parchment, or usually I just put it into a Ziploc bag and set it in the coldest part of my refrigerator for at least 20 minutes before rolling it out. It was not too warm in my kitchen yesterday, so I just waited about 20 or 30 minutes before rolling it out. And I think that this combination made a very nice crust. There are a few different schools of thought with a coconut custard pie, and some people also use the terms coconut custard pie and coconut cream pie interchangeably. But in general, what I've found is that a coconut cream pie is something that resembles lemon meringue pie in that there's a custard on the bottom and then there's meringue coating that on the top. But a coconut custard pie has all of the ingredients mixed together and made into one custard with no topping. But within the coconut custard pie category, there are two camps. In one camp are the folks who blind bake a pie shell, cook the custard on the stovetop, then put the custard into the shell and refrigerate or let that set up. I'm of the school of blind baking the pie shell for just about 10 minutes, then adding uncooked custard mixture to the pie shell and cooking the whole pie together. My mother takes that one step further and typically just puts the custard mixture into the pie shell and bakes the whole thing together. She never seems to have a challenge with that, and sometimes she will use a metal pie dish because the metal heats up more quickly and makes the pie shell crisper at the bottom so that it doesn't get soggy. I do not have metal pie dishes. I only have Pyrex ones. So I do like to blind bake or pre-bake my pie shell for 8 to 12 minutes, I would say, before adding the other ingredients. This coconut custard had a mixture of milk, half and half, vanilla, 3 eggs, a little bit of nutmeg, and the coconut, of course, and it called for self-rising flour. I don't have self-rising flour, and I didn't even look up a substitution. I just put in a tablespoon of regular flour and 1/2 teaspoon of baking powder into the custard mixture. If I had to do it over again, I think I would add another egg to the custard. My eggs were not unusually small. They seemed to the medium large size, but I feel like I could have done with just a little more filling in that pie shell. I will link to a recipe from the Food Network that is very close to the one I used, because the one I used was just handwritten on an index card. I don't even know the origin of this pie recipe, but I just looked around online until I found something quite similar. As I mentioned, I have not yet done any experimenting with the coconut flour. The recipes I found call for a lot of eggs, and I want to wait until I have a huge supply of farm fresh eggs until I try a coconut flour recipe. So I think I will bring this coconut flour with me when my mother and I travel up to visit my sister, who's living off the grid in Vermont at the end of the month. We typically drive up there as soon as I'm finished with my school year, and we stay for a few days helping Jessica around the farm and cooking and crafting together, taking long walks, playing with the dogs, and I'm sure I can finagle some coconut flour experiments into that time together, and maybe I can even get us to record a little bit that I could use on the podcast in the future. Off the shelf. What have you been reading for the Eat Your Words read along? There is fantastic discussion going on the Ravelry boards for the Yarns at Yanhu group. And I have been working on reading along with my book selection, Coming Home to Eat, The Pleasures and Politics of Local Food by Gary Paul Nabon. The author takes a pretty extreme stance on local eating. He lives in the desert in Arizona, and he undertakes to eat food that has originated in a 250-mile radius of his home. In the beginning of this work, he dedicates a lot of time to talking about the resistance that he gets from friends, coworkers, family members about this endeavor. His writing can ramble a little bit. I think that's due to his passion and his interest in the topic. And he talks a lot about native plant species and their origins and the erosion, I guess you could say, of native plant species. I'm enjoying this book, and I do have it in paperback, so I thought that it could be a good idea to add another title on my Kindle app so that I had something with me if I didn't have a paper copy of my book. I just purchased The History of the World in Six Glasses by Tom Standage, and this takes an overview of world history through the lens of six different beverages. I really enjoy books like this that review all the things that you learned or should have learned in school about world history and world economics and culture, but through the very specific lens of food. And in this case, I know there's wine, beer, tea, coffee. I'm not sure what the other two beverages are, but I think this will be a good addition to my summer reading, and I'm really looking forward to getting into it. This week, I was listening to Fresh Air, which is a Philadelphia program, but I listened to it on WNYC on my way home most days. And there was an interview with a first-time novelist, Stephanie Danler. She's the author of Sweet Bitter, which has been published to wide acclaim. And she was talking on the program about her days as a member of the waitstaff in the Union Square Cafe and the restaurant culture and restaurant waitstaff nightlife culture, I guess you could say, in New York City. And the characters in the novel are sort of loosely based on some of her experiences working in the service industry in New York. It sounds like a fascinating read, and if you were interested in something that was food-related fiction, this is a great title to consider. So I will add a link to that in the show notes. There are prizes for participation on the Ravelry thread during June, July, and August. And there is also a giveaway that's running right now. I will announce the winner in episode 126. This is episode 125, so you still have a little bit of time to check out the Ravelry thread for the giveaway. The prize is a skein of Tamar yarn from Blacker Yarns in a beautiful green colorway, fingering weight. And this prize has been donated by Claire of the New Hampshire Knits podcast because she has opened an Etsy shop called The Woolly Thistle. And she is working specifically with imports from the UK that might be more difficult to get your hands on here in the United States. Definitely check out her shop and write a note to enter the giveaway, and I will be drawing the winner in the next episode.
Acorns are dropping off my Jenny's house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Leaves are down like a lady, waiting for a naked man. River bends like an elbow, turning stone to sand. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Sycamore trees are blazing like a rainbow fire. Just like Linda Curtis, burn out on a wire. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, I hope you will consider leaving a star rating or a review on iTunes, or liking the show's Facebook page, or joining the Yarns at Yinhu group on Ravelry. The music for the episode is Sweet, music and lyrics by Samuel St. Thomas, performed by Krista Long and Cesar Diaz. Eat well and stay strong as you hone your post-apocalyptic skill set this week.
Thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine.